Usually when we talk about a map, there's this expectation of permanence. Like geology, you look at a globe, you see the solid black lines separating one nation from another, and there is this comforting illusion that the world is just, well, that it's settled.
Right, that the borders are fixed, the center holds. But that's really just the administrative view of the world.
Yes.
Categorized,
Yeah.
legally bound.
Exactly.
It's how an empire actually prefers you see things as this static ledger of territories.
But then you step into the real world, the world of history and human anthropology, and suddenly that map is alive.
Yeah.
It's breathing. And if you look closely at the edges, like the absolute furthest frontiers of any great power, those solid black lines are actually fraying.
They're rusting.
They're rusting, yes.
Temper.
And that rust tells a story about the collapse of civilizations. So welcome to the Deep Dive. Today we are taking you, the listener, to the absolute geographic edge of the American Empire.
It's quite a trip.
It is. We are heading to the Mariana Islands, specifically the islands of Saipan and Tinian out in the Pacific. We're going to use this incredibly remote place as a microcosm for global civilizational decay and rebirth, honestly.
Yeah.
We're drawing from this fascinating grounding text by Vin Armani called The Vineyard and the Vessel: Leadership at the End of the Empire. And I should be clear up front, we're going to dive into some intense, sometimes politically charged material from the book. But our mission isn't to take a side.
No, not at all. We're just unpacking the ideas, impartially reporting on the mechanics Armani lays out.
Exactly.
Yep.
So for me, as a cultural anthropologist, I'm approaching this through the lens of indigenous societies. I want to look at the spiritual trust of the land itself. What happens to the cultural trauma of a people when they become utterly dependent? Because, I mean, you really cannot understand the economic mechanics of an empire without understanding the psychological devastation that basically paves the way for it.
And that's where I come in because I want to counterweight that to really understand what's happening out there and, what it means for the global systems you and I rely on every single day. We have to strip away the sentimentality.
Right.
I'm looking at this as a macroeconomist. We have to examine the cold, hard mechanics of institutional power, monetary sovereignty, real politic, and most importantly, the sovereign's absolute monopoly on violence, because the Marianas is the ultimate petri dish for studying the life cycle of a superpower.
It really is. So, to set the stage for you, we have to go back. We have to go back to the summer of 1944 because we have to look at the absolute annihilation of self-sufficiency.
The invasion of the Marianas, Operation Forager.
Yes. So before 1944, the indigenous populations there, the Chamorro and Carolinian people, they lived in this very complex, largely self-sustaining agricultural reality.
Right, a localized economy.
Yeah. It wasn't paradise, but it was functional. They understood the seasonal cycles of the soil. They knew how to build, how to fish, how to navigate. And then the American military machine arrived as a literal force of nature to wrest control of the islands from the Japanese.
The scale of that violence is almost hard to comprehend.
It is. For weeks, the naval bombardments reduced Saipan and Tinian to a wasteland of fire and steel. They unleashed a level of ordnance that effectively erased the agricultural capacity of the islands. Like every structure, every tree that provided fruit was just decimated.
Wiped off the map.
Yeah. And the indigenous people, the ancestral landlords of this soil, were forced to retreat into the literal earth. They hid in these limestone caves for weeks while the world above them was systematically unmade.
Which, from an economic standpoint, is a total reset of their material reality. I mean, their capital stock was reduced to zero.
I would actually say below zero because the trauma fundamentally rewired them. When they finally emerged from those caves, they weren't the masters of their domain anymore. They emerged as a people in waiting. Because the bombardment had destroyed the capacity of the land to sustain life, the American military immediately stepped in as the sole provider. For 2 years, the native population was held in internment camps, and their survival became entirely dependent on military rations.
The sea rations, the imported food.
Exactly. And this forged an incredibly deep psychological trauma bond. They learned this brutal lesson that survival no longer comes from your relationship with the earth or your community. It comes from the hand of the conqueror.
And that dependency, it wasn't just a temporary wartime measure. That's the crucial part. It became institutionalized.
It became their entire worldview. And this trauma was repeated decades later in 1968 with Super Typhoon Jean, another massive destruction of the islands. And again, what happens? The American military arrives with concrete, canned goods, and imported cargo.
It reinforced the cycle.
Yes. It taught the local population to identify their survival not with their own hands, not with their own ancestral knowledge, but completely with the protector's logistic supply chain.
Well, let's look at how that psychological state perfectly serves the pragmatic calculus of the American Empire, because we have to fast forward to the geopolitical reality of 1975.
Okay.
The United States, which Armani refers to in the text as the producers or the American tenant, was deep in the Cold War at this point. They desperately needed to secure the Marianas to maintain the quote-unquote rules-based international order in the Pacific.
Right.
And the topography of Tinian specifically is a high, flat plateau. It is essentially a massive, natural, unsinkable aircraft carrier.
I mean, it's literally the very island from which the Enola Gay launched to drop the atomic bomb on Hiroshima.
Exactly. So the strategic value is almost incalculable. The U.S. needed to ensure that the Soviet Union could never turn the Northern Marianas into a Pacific Cuba. They needed absolute control over that airspace and those deep water harbors.
But they had a problem.
A massive legal hurdle. In the 1970s, during the era of the United Nations and the whole global push for decolonization, the U.S. couldn't just plant a flag and formally conquer the territory.
Right, the optics would be terrible.
Terrible. They needed a legally binding lease to satisfy international law. But here is the problem. There was no formal, legally recognized landlord to sign the lease. The indigenous population was disorganized and not recognized as a sovereign nation state.
So the empire simply invented one.
That is the political theology of the 1975 covenant. The United States literally called the people of the Northern Mariana Islands into existence as a formal corporate legal entity. They basically drafted a constitution for them.
Which is wild to think about.
It is. And why did they do it? For the sole explicit purpose of having a counterparty to sign over control of 17,799 acres on Tinian and the deep water harbors of Saipan, they manufactured a landlord to legitimize their tenancy.
See, I have to push back on treating this strictly as a clever legal maneuver or, you know, a line item on a geopolitical lease.
Fair enough.
When you frame it purely as a contract, you ignore the metaphysical reality of what a homeland is to an indigenous people. The text introduces this vital concept of the divine landlord.
Right, the spiritual framing.
Yes. It's this ancient vertical reality. The idea that no human, no tribe, no nation actually owns a single square inch of the earth. We are all, at best, conditional tenants. We occupy the vineyard under a lease granted by a higher authority, by the divine, the ultimate sovereign, if you will. Exactly. The landlord provides the soil, the rain, the seasons, and the human tenant is expected to provide the fruit. And in this framework, the fruit isn't just agricultural yield, it's justice, local autonomy, the preservation of tradition, and righteous stewardship of the community.
Right.
When the local people of the Marianas signed that 1975 covenant, they forgot their spiritual ownership. They traded their profound, localized leverage as the guardians of that specific soil for 100 years of guaranteed American cargo, federal grants, and U.S. passports.
They took the deal.
They did. But they suffered a massive spiritual amnesia in the process. By abdicating their stewardship for the comfort of dependency, they stopped being stewards of the vineyard. The text says they became wretched tenants in their own homeland, essentially sitting on their porches waiting for federal donations.
Well, from an economic perspective, that is the ultimate Faustian bargain, right? You trade your autonomy, your capacity to produce, and in exchange, the empire gives you an artificial standard of living you could never achieve on your own.
Exactly.
It solves the empire's legal problem and completely neuters the local population's desire to rebel. Because why bite the hand that feeds you spam?
Right, but that raises such a glaring question for anyone looking at this rationally.
Mm.
If the United States leased this massive amount of land, this incredible strategic asset in the Pacific, why didn't they build a thriving, productive, self-sufficient economy on it? Like, why not turn Saipan and Tinian into technological powerhouses or massive economic hubs?
Because an economic hub is a liability.
Wait, explain that.
To answer that, we have to look at the dark economic reality of strategic vacuums. In military strategy, there is a concept known as resource denial.
Okay.
We usually think of empires expanding to extract resources, right? Like the Spanish mining gold in South America, or the British extracting spices and tea from India.
So extraction colonialism.
Exactly. But in the grand theater of a mature empire, land is often immensely valuable, not for what it can produce for the sovereign, but simply to ensure an enemy cannot have it.
Wow. So it's the no man's land of the imperial chessboard.
It is a deliberate void. For the U.S. military, Tinian is not a place to build a bustling metropolis. It is a buffer to protect their massive, critical military stronghold just to the south on Guam. The American tenant actually has a direct economic and strategic incentive to keep this periphery fallow, stagnant, or even depopulated.
Hearing that laid out so clinically, I mean, it's incredibly cynical.
It is the cold math of empire. Think about the incentives here. If the Northern Marianas develops a booming independent economy, if it attracts massive foreign investment from rival nations, say China or Russia, it suddenly becomes an attractive target. It becomes entangled. It becomes geopolitical vulnerability. Therefore, from the perspective of the Pentagon, a docile, dependent population surviving on federal grants and imported welfare is strategically vastly superior to a vibrant, fiercely independent population.
Because an independent, wealthy society might eventually say no to the military's demand.
Exactly. A dependent society cannot afford to say no.
But the human cost of that calculus is devastating. It's essentially invisible violence. When you treat a people's homeland as nothing more than a strategic vacuum, you systematically destroy the spirit of the body, the esprit de corps of that society.
Internal cohesion.
Right. Morale is the spiritual vessel of any community. It's what allows them to innovate, to raise strong children, to build a future. When a society is forced into a state of suspended animation, where their only purpose is to occupy space so a rival power can't, they are denied the fundamental human right to grow.
They're kept in a permanent adolescence.
Yes. They're denied the struggle that builds character. It's a slow generational death by stagnation.
And Armani uses a brilliant analogy here that perfectly encapsulates this dynamic of the empire as a suffocating protector. He talks about the Kangal dog.
The Turkish shepherd dog, right. The ones used in the hills of Anatolia.
Right. The Kangal dog guards the sheep. It is a massive, fearsome beast, essentially an apex predator bred to fight off wolves and bears. But the paradox of the protector is this. To protect the sheep from the wolf, the Kangal must be fearsome enough to kill the wolf.
Right.
But that inherently means the protector is also perfectly capable of killing the sheep.
The protector represents a true predatory threat to the flock. And this is the inherent danger of the imperial protector. When the protector stops serving the shepherd, which again, in our vertical spiritual framework, is the divine order, the pursuit of justice and genuine flourishing, and starts acting only for its own preservation, it mutates.
It becomes something else entirely.
It becomes a tyrant. The tyrant manages the flock not to see them thrive, but merely to ensure its own future food supply, or in the case of the Marianas, its own strategic buffer zone. The dog realizes it runs the valley, not the shepherd.
Exactly. And because the imperial tenant doesn't want the land to produce real independent capital, because it wants to enforce that resource denial, the people must be kept alive through alternative means. The flock has to be fed somehow, otherwise they die or revolt.
Which leads us directly into the macroeconomic tragedy of imported goods and how it completely hollows out a society. Let's talk about cargo colonialism.
Let's do it.
Because this is where the anthropology and the economics crash into each other. We have to make a very clear distinction for you listening. We aren't just talking about global trade. We have to contrast capital goods with consumable cargo.
A vital distinction.
Capital goods are things like lumber, steel beams, heavy tractors, commercial fishing nets, tools that allow a society to build, to manufacture, and to produce more value locally. Consumable cargo is entirely different. It's cans of Spam, video games, fast fashion, refined sugar, cheap plastics.
Cargo cannot be planted. It cannot be built upon. From a macro perspective, it's a pure depreciation of wealth.
It is a zero-sum game. Every can of Spam consumed is a local seed that was not planted. Every imported pair of sneakers is a local cobbler who never learned the trade. And the text details the deeply tragic loss of ancestral skills to illustrate this.
The canoe navigation.
Yes, the traditional Saitawal canoe navigation of Chief Uguru. These indigenous people were among the greatest open ocean navigators in human history. I mean, they navigated the vast, terrifying expanse of the Pacific without compasses, without sextants, reading only the stars, the ocean swells, and the flight paths of birds.
True mastery of their environment.
And now, those schools are literally rotting in the jungle. Why? Because the people rely entirely on massive diesel-powered container ships bringing foreign goods. The population becomes entirely disconnected from the economic realities of production.
They just wait for the ship.
Right. When the cargo arrives at the port, it almost looks like magic, like sorcery, because no one on the island knows how to mine the metal, refine the oil, or manufacture the goods inside those containers.
And this engineered dependency creates a highly specific, highly pathological type of economy. The text calls it the donation state.
This part is so revealing.
As an economist, this is where the structural perversity of the imperial periphery really shines. In a normal developing economy, you want efficiency, right? You want good roads, fast internet, streamlined regulations. But in a donation state, you develop a parasitocracy.
A parasitocracy.
Exactly. The local governing elites actually have a massive built-in incentive to let the public infrastructure rot.
See, I remember reading this and having to pause. Walk through the logic for the listener. Why on earth would the local mayors and governors want their own power grids to fail or their own roads to be full of potholes?
Because a modernized, highly efficient, technologically advanced state requires significantly fewer workers.
Oh, wow.
Right. If you automate the Department of Motor Vehicles, you fire 50 clerks. If you bring in a highly efficient, mechanized private waste management company, you lay off 100 local trash collectors.
Okay, I see where this is going.
But in a donation state, there is virtually no private sector. The empire's mandate of resource denial has stifled independent capital formation. So menial government jobs are literally the only way the local elite can employ themselves, their extended families, and their political supporters.
So it's a patronage network.
A massive one. They essentially use the government payroll as a welfare distribution system to buy loyalty. If they fix the infrastructure and make it efficient, they lose the jobs.
That's insidious.
It gets worse. Furthermore, they must keep the society visibly desperate to ensure the empire back in Washington, D.C. keeps the spigot of financial donations and disaster relief grants flowing.
Because if the island looks too successful, too well managed, the federal grants stop.
Precisely. The worse things get, the more they get paid. It's an entirely perverse incentive structure that rewards decay. And this ties into a deeper macroeconomic theory outlined in the text. The rule of consolidation, concession, and commission.
Break that down for us.
This is how sovereigns extract rent. Remember, a sovereign is fundamentally defined by its monopoly on violence. They use that monopoly to extract value from a territory.
Right, through taxes, fees, licensing, the threat of imprisonment if you don't comply.
Yes. Now, there are three ways a government can operate its revenue-generating enterprises. The first is consolidation. This is when the government uses its own direct employees to perform services, regardless of how inefficient it is.
Okay.
Think of a bloated bureaucratic agency where a worker gets paid the same salary whether they help 10 people a day or 100.
We all know a few of those.
Right. The second is concession. This is privatization selling a license or a franchise to a private company to do the work, and the government takes a fee.
Like a toll road.
Exactly. The third is commission.
Yeah.
This is a true public-private partnership where the government acts as a capitalist, sharing in the actual profit and risk of the enterprise.
Okay, so where does the donation state fit in?
In a donation state, the local government relies almost exclusively on consolidation. They bloat the payroll with local labor to distribute the imperial cargo. They consolidate all power and employment within the state apparatus, absolutely ensuring the local economy can never become efficient, competitive, or self-sustaining.
So the local elites are essentially acting as middle managers for the empire's welfare system. They skim their cut, they maintain their social status, while the underlying spiritual and productive capacity of their own people just atrophies.
That's exactly it.
But this local dependency, this specific tragedy in the Marianas, is really just one fractal layer of how empires control populations globally. If we zoom out, we have to look at how this power is structured on a massive scale.
Which brings us to an incredible macro-historical framework. Armani methodically breaks down the three distinct layers of human hierarchical reality: country, nation, and empire.
We use these words completely interchangeably in everyday conversation today.
Yeah.
But functionally, mechanically, they are entirely different modes of human organization. I love this part of the analysis. Let's break down the first layer.
Right. So the foundational layer of human organization is the country. A country is bound by blood and geography. It is biological. Think of the etymology of the words we use. England, the land of the Angles. Afghanistan, the place of the Afghans.
Right.
It is ruled by a chief, someone embedded in the kinship hierarchy. And here is the brutal historical truth. A country expands via annihilation and assimilation. It is a biological zero-sum replacement of people. You clear the land of the competing tribe to make room for your own bloodline to hunt and farm.
It's a deeply tribal, physical reality tied directly to the soil.
Next, moving up the ladder of complexity, we have the nation. A nation is bound not primarily by blood, but by the word, by law, religion, or ideology. It was ruled by a king or a centralized state apparatus.
So it's an idea.
Yes. Because it is ideological, a nation can be multi-ethnic. A nation expands not by killing everyone, but via indoctrination. Think of Romanization in the ancient world or Americanization today. You teach the conquered people your language, you give them your legal code, you convert them to your religion, and you integrate them into your national identity.
You are essentially turning the savage into the civilian through the power of the nation's ideology.
And finally, we reach the highest, most abstract layer of coordination, the empire. An empire is bound by the money, by the market. It is ruled by an emperor, or in our modern era, a central banking system and a military-industrial complex.
And how does it expand?
An empire expands via coordination. The empire doesn't necessarily care what god you pray to locally or what your local municipal laws are or what bloodline you come from. The empire only cares that you use their currency, service their debt, and trade within their market.
So apply that to the American empire today. How does that map onto our current reality?
Well, the modern imperial shift is fascinating. The modern American empire is not defined by its physical borders. It's not defined by the U.S. Constitution reaching new lands.
Right. We aren't annexing territories in the traditional sense.
No. The greater U.S. empire is defined by the reach of the U.S. dollar and global digital payment networks like Visa, MasterCard, and SWIFT. If we want to know the true borders of the empire, we just have to look at dollarization.
Okay. Give an example.
Look at distant nations, places with zero ethnic or historical ties to America, like Liberia, Zimbabwe, Timor-Leste, El Salvador. They have formally adopted the U.S. dollar as their official currency.
They've completely surrendered their monetary sovereignty.
Entirely. They no longer control their own interest rates or their own money supply. They are digital economic citizens of the reigning monetary empire. The empire's true borders are financial, not physical.
I see the cold, undeniable logic in that, but I really had to push back on treating this purely as an economic victory or a clean administrative system of global coordination. Because the cultural cost of this imperial coordination is catastrophic for the indigenous reality. The text applies a great analogy here that usually belongs to family wealth. Shirt sleeves to shirt sleeves in three generations.
Right. The old adage that the first generation makes the wealth, the second generation maintains it, and the third generation squanders it and ends up back in shirt sleeves.
But apply that to cultural wealth and survivor skills. Why does that collapse happen?
Yeah.
It happens because of a breakdown in tradition and mentorship. In a healthy indigenous society, down at that biological country layer you described, tradition is the immune system.
Interesting way to put it.
It is. Tradition is the mechanism that transfers wisdom, survival skills, and values across dozens of generations. It's what prevents the three-generation collapse. But when the empire layer rolls in with its hyper-individualistic, cargo-driven money system, it actively replaces traditional mentorship.
The incentives change.
Radically. The local elite class stops looking to their elders for wisdom. They look to the imperial center for funding. They align themselves with the market, not the blood. And in doing so, the indigenous identity, the deep sustaining roots of the country layer, is slowly, methodically erased.
They become standardized?
Yes. The people become nothing more than standardized economic units of consumption. They trade their cultural heritage, the unique localized knowledge, for access to the imperial currency and the cargo it buys. It is a massive structural trade-off.
Which brings us to the most terrifying macroeconomic question of this entire text.
And what's that?
What happens to a dollarized, cargo-dependent periphery when the emperor's treasury at the core finally runs dry?
Oh, what happens when the ships stop coming?
This is where we examine the concept of rust at the edges.
Like you mentioned at the start of the deep dive.
Exactly. The collapse of a massive global coordination machine doesn't happen overnight at the center. It doesn't start in Washington, D.C. or Rome. It starts as entropy at the extreme periphery. Think of a massive piece of machinery rusting. It starts on the exposed surface, on the fringes, long before the engine block fails.
Makes sense.
We have a perfect historical parallel for this that the author dives into. Roman Britain in 410 AD.
This comparison is chilling when you realize how closely it mirrors our current trajectory.
It really is. So for four centuries, Britannia was a fully integrated, highly functional part of the Roman Empire. The people living there weren't just conquered subjects, they were Roman citizens.
Right.
They used Roman silver coins, they participated in a massive Mediterranean-wide economic market, they had villas with heated floors, imported wines from Gaul, specialized industries.
Very advanced for the time.
But by the early 5th century, the Roman state was facing massive internal economic decay, hyperinflation, and external pressure from barbarian incursions. So what did the central planners do? They executed the ultimate triage. They withdrew the legions from Britain to defend the core in Italy.
They abandoned the periphery to save the center.
Exactly. And when the legions left, the imperial payment cycle stopped. The silver stopped flowing. The coordination broke down. And what happened to Britain?
I mean, it wasn't good.
They didn't just have a severe recession. They experienced a total civilizational reset. They were plunged into the Dark Ages.
Mm-hmm.
And here is the crucial, terrifying point. It wasn't because all the humans died. The population was still there. The resources were still there.
So what was missing?
It was because the infrastructure of imperial coordination collapsed. Without the Roman market to sell to, highly specialized skills like kiln-fired pottery, complex iron smelting, and advanced masonry literally vanished within a single generation.
Yeah.
The roofs collapsed. The roads fell apart. They slipped completely out of history because they had forgotten how to survive without the empire coordinating their existence.
They were completely dependent on the empire's cargo.
Yeah.
And when the cargo stopped, they had no localized capital to fall back on.
None.
And the modern parallel the author draws to this is terrifyingly exact.
Mm-hmm.
The text brings us back to the Marianas, specifically painting a projected scenario in April 2026, Super Typhoon Sinlaku, a storm that dwarfs previous disasters.
A catalyst event.
Right. The people retreat into their concrete bunkers, their modern caves, expecting the American military to arrive with relief, just like they did in 1944, just like they did in 1968. But this time, the rust has reached the core.
The sovereign back in Washington is facing its own internal crises. Supply chain collapses, a massive fuel crisis, crippling national debt, the logistics stall. The center is finally too weak, too distracted, too broke to project power and relief to the extreme edge.
The cargo doesn't arrive.
The ships don't come.
The people emerge from their bunkers to find that the imperial tenant has fundamentally abdicated its defense and relief responsibilities. The 100-year lease signed in 1975 has been broken by reality itself.
The system breaks.
And the people are left standing on a rusted imperial carcass, entirely dependent on a system that no longer exists, having forgotten the ancestral skills, the canoe building, the farming, the fishing, that allowed them to survive on those islands for thousands of years before the empire arrived.
This is the ultimate fatal danger of the trauma bond and the donation state. It sets a population up for a localized apocalypse when the macro system fails.
And this brings us to a vital distinction the author makes. One that is crucial for understanding how to navigate this kind of collapse. He makes a distinction between a crisis and a crisis spelled with a K.
I think this is the most important framework in the book.
It is. A crisis with a C is a present, immediate emergency. A hurricane hits, the power goes out, a market crashes. This type of event is managed by an organizational temporal leader.
Like a mayor or a governor.
Think of King Herod in the biblical narrative. He manages the present moment. He worries about his immediate social standing. He appeases the crowd. He keeps the current system running.
He's a manager. He optimizes the status quo.
Right. But a crisis with a K is something entirely different. It is an unseen turning point in the future. It is a fundamental civilizational shift. You cannot manage a crisis with standard operating procedures, federal grant applications, or committee meetings.
It requires a completely different approach.
A crisis can only be navigated by a prophetic leader. Think of the story of Noah. He is building a massive ark out of gopher wood on dry land where the sky is perfectly blue. The crowd thinks he is absolutely insane, but he is oriented toward a future reality they cannot yet perceive.
Or consider John the Baptist standing out in the wilderness, refusing the comforts of the city, recognizing that the entire age is about to turn. If the edge of the empire is rusting away and the cargo ships are never coming back, the standard organizational leader is going to fail catastrophically. You can't fill out a FEMA grant application if the federal government is collapsing. You can't rely on the donation state if the donor is bankrupt.
Exactly.
So the ultimate question is, how do the people survive the crisis?
Which brings us to the final act of this deep dive. How do we restore the vessel when the empire leaves us stranded.
To survive an economic and civilizational reset of this magnitude, a society absolutely cannot rely on committees. The text is very clear and quite brutal on this point.
No, so.
Committees, whether it's the city council, the conclave, or the presidential cabinet, are designed to manage the known world. They require consensus. But in a crisis, consensus is a death sentence because the crowd is always tethered to the dying system.
Right. The crowd wants the cargo to come back.
Exactly. Committees inevitably corrupt when the system breaks down because they try to preserve their own power within a paradigm that no longer exists. You need a singular, distinct type of leader to bridge the gap.
You need liminal leadership. This is such a powerful, resonant concept in the book.
Define that for the listener.
The word limen means threshold in Latin. A liminal leader is someone who exists on the borderlands. They stand exactly at the threshold between the old, dying world and the new, unseen world. They are the bridge.
Right. They have to be part of the community they lead, so they have legitimacy. But they must answer to a higher vertical authority. They must answer to the reality of the crisis, not just the panic demands of the crowd.
Consider the mythology of King Arthur. The historical model for Arthur wasn't some polished medieval knight in shining armor. He was a Romano Briton standing in the muddy ruins of the Roman Empire.
The exact scenario we were just talking about.
Yes, the Roman legions are gone, the infrastructure's collapsing, the Saxons are invading. Arthur is a liminal figure who synthesizes the dying Roman traditions of law and order with the raw indigenous Celtic realities to forge a completely new culture out of the darkness. He bridges the end of the empire and the birth of a new localized reality.
That's a perfect example.
Or think of Maupialoog, the modern Sahrawi's master navigator who brought traditional wayfinding back to the Hawaiian people in the 1970s. He stepped out of the modern, dependent paradigm. He threw away the compass, he threw away the GPS, and he navigated the Hokulea across thousands of miles of open ocean using only the stars, the ocean currents, and the ancient map drawn on his soul.
He trusted the tradition over the cargo.
Exactly. The liminal leader has to step off the rusting ship of the empire and bridge the known and the unknown.
What's fascinating from a systems perspective is that this synthesis is actually inevitable. When the thesis of the empire meets the antithesis of the indigenous reality and the whole overarching system collapses, a new synthesis must emerge.
It has to.
The breakdown of the empire's edges is terrifying, yes. The loss of cargo, the collapse of the donation state, the evaporation of the imperial security blanket, it is chaotic and deeply painful, but it is not purely a tragedy.
It's a clearing of the brush. It is the fire that cracks open the seed.
It is the exact necessary wilderness required for a new cultural synthesis to be born. When the imperial lease is finally revoked by the divine landlord, it forces a brutal reckoning.
Yeah.
The people can no longer rely on the illusion of cargo. They are forced to pick up the traditional map of their ancestors. They are forced to remember how to produce, how to build capital,
right,
how to survive without the umbilical cord of the sovereign. They are forced to restore their own vessel.
It's a return to authentic tradition born out of absolute necessity. It's the ultimate realization that the map was never permanent.
Right.
And that is where I want to turn this conversation directly to you, the listener. Because while we've spent this time talking about the geopolitics of the Mariana Islands, the fall of Roman Britain, and the macroeconomics of the donation state, this deep dive is really about the structure of your own reality. I want you to examine your own life right now. Look at the complex systems you depend on for your daily survival. Are you relying on the cargo of an empire that is beginning to rust at the edges? Think about the skills you actually possess. What traditional skills, what local autonomy, what physical or spiritual resilience have you outsourced to a distant center?
Have you traded your own sovereign ability to produce for the mere convenience of consuming?
Because history shows us that the rust always spreads from the edges to the core. And when the modern cargo ships stop arriving, whether literally through supply chain failures or metaphorically through the collapse of the institutions you trust, who will you be? Will you be a wretched tenant sitting in a concrete cave waiting for a donation from a dying king? Or will you be ready to step into the wilderness, look to the stars, and restore your own vessel?